You're listening to the Modern Web Podcast. For more podcasts, videos, and events, find us online at modern-web.org or follow us on Twitter at modern.web. That's modern.web.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Modern Web Podcast. Today we have my two co-hosts here today, Adam Rackus and Rob Osell.
Hello.
Yep. Hey everybody.
So Rob, I've been watching your videos lately and you always start off with, hello everyone. So that's how I'm going to, every time I talk to you, I'm just going to say, hello, Rob.
I'm a creature of habit. I like...
It's very consistent.
Get started. Yep.
Yeah. And we have Kevin joining us today. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Very stoked to be here.
Yeah. I just noticed your background. For those of you watching on camera, Kevin has an arcade machine in the back.
Yeah, that's right. So I used to work at a company called Twilio. And while there, I made a PC game called Twilio Quest that taught developers how to like use the Twilio API, but also taught like JavaScript and Python and other programming stuff. And we made it into a physical cabinet. And that is like the cabinet we used to take to events. Like we took it to like PyCon and a couple other places over the years. So yeah, that's why it's got like a QWERTY keyboard and is kind of goofy looking. So...
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So,
Adam,
like, you just gotta keep it.
Where's your League of Legends cabinet?
I should have done that. That would have been maybe more useful than like the Mac Mini inside the giant closet thing back there. But
yeah. Wait, did you work on League too?
Oh no, that would have been pretty sweet. But like, I think it was maybe a general comment that League of Legends would be a sweet arcade cabinet. I had nothing to do with that.
You may have been talking to me. I used to work at Riot.
Yeah, I was joking with Adam. Where's Adam's League of Legends cabinet? That would be cool.
Oh, right. Oh, sweet. That would be pretty cool.
Well, does anybody get free stuff? Like, I mean, Adam, do you get free stuff working? Did you get free stuff working at Riot?
Got some hoodies.
Yeah. It's like everyone at Netflix is like, so do you get a free subscription? And all my friends at Netflix are like, no, we do not. We do not get free subscription.
That's amazing, by the way.
That you don't get it?
Yeah. Well, like when you used to work at Blizzard, I know you would get like on your first day, they would give you every game they ever released and like lifetime subscriptions to all their products.
Nice.
That would be sweet.
But I mean, that would be like the demise of Netflix, right? Because like every Netflix employee, you know, then shares their password. And then, you know, all of those families share their passwords and this like this chain effect that like, what is it? The 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, is it?
Yep.
So then like, you know, Netflix then doesn't exist as a company, which by the way, funny story, my friend Jay Phelps came to my house. He works at Netflix and he decided to log my sister out of her account at Netflix because she doesn't live here. And I was like, bro, I was using her account. Okay. Come on. What is this? But no, of course, Jay.
That's cool.
Yeah. He's a company man. I don't have her login anymore.
Anybody from Netflix is watching. No longer. Recently, password.
Did I subscribe?
After he had locked you out of your sister.
No. No, I just don't watch TV anymore because I have children. So.
You're missing out on
all Coco Melon for the next couple years.
It is. Although he's sick of Coco Melon. Now it's Miss Rachel. And who is it? Blippi.
Oh, yeah. So. You're on the Blippi train.
Blippi and Miss Rachel.
Enjoy.
Hi, friends. Like, why do you laugh like that? Okay. Anyways, so more importantly, Kevin today is going to tell us all the secrets that we don't know about Deno or Dino.
Well, we'll start with that secret, yeah. Which is that Dino is the canonical pronunciation, but when it was originally announced by Ryan Dahl, who's the original author of Node.js and then created Dino, in the first talk that he introduced it, he said Deno, and then later decided that it would be better, like sort of pronounced as Dino. So it sort of switched. But as a result, now there's kind of two pronunciations of Dino that kind of exist out in the wild. So that we can start there. Dino is the way to say it.
I feel like y'all missed a train on Dino.
We could have. I think the idea was you rearrange and sort the letters of Node, and you get Dino
specifically. Oh, cute. Yeah. That was a secret I did not know.
Yeah, yeah, right on. So, yeah, but I mean, it's a very exciting project. If you haven't checked it out, it's sort of a alternative JavaScript runtime to Node.js. So it natively speaks TypeScript. It has kind of built-in tooling like a linter, a test framework. It even compiles, a single executable that bundles your code along with the Dino runtime, so you can just run it with a single command. And yeah, lots of other great developer experience features in addition to being pretty fast. It's built on Rust and Tokio and can handle HTTP operations pretty efficiently and actually ends up outperforming Node in a decent number of scenarios, even using like Node libraries, like existing Node libraries. So great developer experience based on web standards whenever possible. That's another kind of key feature of Dino, is that we try to use browser APIs whenever possible and not expose like sort of Dino specific APIs. If there is a web standard that exists around a given API, we will sort of go in that direction. So we try to make it as sort of make your code sort of as portable with the browser environment as possible too.
Doesn't Dino power Netlify functions, or am I remembering that wrong?
Yeah, that's correct. So yeah, if you've used Netlify functions, that's actually the Dino runtime under the covers, specifically using Dino Deploy, which is like the cloud infrastructure that Dino's created. That's sort of, instead of being based around virtual machines, it's based around like V8 isolates. So it's a little bit like in the cloud, there's a bunch of Chrome browsers and a new browser tab gets like spun up to respond to incoming requests on the edge, which ends up being a pretty efficient way to sort of spin up and down functions and effectively manage resources.
And y'all raised money, right? So it's venture backed?
Yeah, so Dino company, Series A investment, I don't know, maybe like a year and a half ago or something, like, mm-hmm. something along those lines. I'm not sure what the timeline was, but Series A funding. The commercial side of the business is largely that cloud offering. But most of our work is actually in open source. So the Dino runtime itself is MIT licensed and open source. And JSR too, the new registry, which I'm sure we'll dig into, is also free and open source too.
Yeah, tell us about that. So when is that taking over the world? And what percentage have migrated?
As a percentage of the 2.5 million packages or whatever on NPM right now, it's still a pretty small percentage that is on JSR, but also JSR has only been in public beta for a couple weeks. So we have some time still manage the rest of the migration.
You just need Adam to tweet about it. Adam, when are you tweeting about like, I've migrated everything over to...
Indeed. When are you
tweeting? When, Adam, when? Right now.
We'll all sit here and wait.
Just real quick. JSR, I don't know if I've given the spiel yet, but it's a TypeScript first ECMAScript module registry that works across JavaScript runtimes and is kind of designed to be runtime agnostic. In Dino, it's very fast and efficient because it uses HTTP imports the way that Dino does today. In Node-like environments that, are maybe use Yarn or PNPM or NPM as package manager clients, you can still install and use JSR packages in those environments as well, kind of in the same ways, because those package managers are extensible with custom registries. So we've set up JSR as like a custom NPM registry, which you can then use in the context of existing Node and NPM projects. So as a module publisher, you get to publish TypeScript source. You don't have to worry about transpilation. API docs are generated for you and hosted on your packages, JSR page. You get a lot of niceties, like it's very easy to set up continuous integration with GitHub Actions. So you can, every time there's a merge to like your main branch, say, you can publish a new version of your package to JSR if the version has been updated. So for module publishers, we hope it ends up being pretty convenient way to like host cross-platform TypeScript packages. And as a consumer, if you're using Dino or Node today, it's basically zero cost to switch. Like the command to install it is slightly different, but it uses the same mechanisms that you're already using to manage packages in your project right now. But you get to have like nice API docs for your packages and benefit from some of like the end user features of JSR2. Like packages have like an automated quality score around like, do they have documentation? Have they implemented TypeScript features? Like, do they always declare return types? Are all their arguments typed, or is there like inference happening? So there's ways in which you can also gauge the quality of packages that you're consuming from JSR. So we're hoping that developers are enjoying it, and it's still very early days. We're learning a lot from community feedback, but so far the reception has been pretty positive, and we're stoked to continue iterating on it.
One of the things that's really cool about the website itself is I found it was really fun to just browse it, to just surf the packages that were there. I think largely because of that score value. What was interesting about the score wasn't necessarily the actual number itself, although that's going to be informative when you decide what packages to import. But what I liked about the score is it not only broke down what parts made up the score, but then it links to documentation talking about why that's important. And it struck me how little documentation as a community we have around package like deployments and how to be a good steward of an open source library for different categories, and how this was actually a pretty reasonable way for me even to be like, oh, it uses slow types. What are slow types? And like just getting an interesting link into the documentation. Why was the score such a thing? Because that doesn't strike me as Dino specific. That just seems like an idea for innovating the idea of a registry.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we came up with is, I think you nailed it. One of the reasons to have a sort of checklist like that in a score is to just provide some rails for the experience of publishing so that publishers know, oh, like these are the things I should probably do. I should ensure that I declare which runtime environments my module supports. I should make sure my package has a description, and I should do these other things. So it allows us to kind of give developers a roadmap for like, okay, this is kind of like the baseline for having a pretty successful package. Or if like you haven't included JS doc comments for most of your module, there's also sort of a poke that you get like, hey, you haven't documented most of your interfaces and that sort of thing. So yeah, that ends up being pretty useful. It also is like a lot of the NPM registry, like, can be like really old, and some of it doesn't have documentation. And like we want to sort of, as the registry progresses, try to surface the best possible packages for a given purpose within like search and stuff like that too. So like a quality score will hopefully be a part of how we do that in the future.
That's kind of amazing. I feel like it's teaching everybody like best practices or pushing for, but you should do something like really weird to just like mess everybody up, give somebody a score and everybody will start optimizing it for it. And you're like, no, it's not what we meant to do.
Yeah. I mean, that is the danger of like, having incentives to, game the system or like get a 100% score. So like I think that's something to consider is like, it shouldn't ever be valuable enough to have a 100% score such that it would be worth it to like game the system to get a 100% score. Like hopefully it'll act more as like, guardrails versus, something where like, oh, I got to get 100% no matter what.
I don't know though. I mean, does everybody want to be a B+ player? Or does everyone want to be an A+ player?
I think a lot of us in the software development world probably would be the latter, but yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the harder questions that people have asked you that you're kind of working through right now and some of the solutions you guys have come up with?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The annoying ones, like the ones where you're like, ugh, why?
Yeah, annoying would be a strong word, but like there is there's a lot of sort of seldom used or sort of exotic features of NPM that we're kind of discovering as we build the compatibility layer with Node projects. Some of those have been tricky. also like existing TypeScript code bases that are looking to publish to JSR. Sometimes they can use like techniques that are have been like a little tricky for us to like apply the same standards that we can apply to like Dino source code, which has like a consistent set of like TypeScript compiler settings to like other TypeScript code bases that where like types are actually disabled and not checked, you know, during the transpilation process, which seems super weird because why use TypeScript if you're going to do that? But like, so there are some, you know, compatibility things with existing projects that we're still kind of working through as we encounter them. But like the goal is that like if you have a TypeScript based you know, code base and you're publishing to NPM today, ideally you should just be able to drop in like a jsr.json, which has like, you know, three fields that have like your package name, your version, and like your exports. And like ideally that just kind of works. So that does work in some percentage of the time, but we're looking to like push that percentage closer to like 90-95%. It's kind of, so that's like the biggest challenge I think for us right now.
Are you just doing like a translation on any common JS exports and just converting them to ESM as part of your compatibility layer?
We're not doing that as a part of like publishing to the registry yet, but actually that very thing has been discussed like in the last few days actually of like, well, let's say an existing code base does have, you know, CJS modules in it. Could we just sort of automatically treat them as, you know, ESM modules under the covers? So it could be that we will actually ship some compatibility features there. For now, you can't actually publish CJS modules to the registry. Like you'll get an error at publish time saying like that's not currently supported. Yeah, so I mean, those are maybe some of the challenges. Also, like we just have the normal new website stuff. Like we shipped a change that made like the logo giant for like 15 minutes. So we, you know, backed out some CSS changes. But yeah, so far the uptime has been pretty good. Like JSR was designed in such a way where like there's just not very many moving parts like to serving packages. Like it's all the package like artifacts are stored in you know, Google Cloud, you know, storage buckets. So it's pretty cheap to run. And we also wanted it to be pretty easily self-hostable. So if somebody wanted to, you know, host their own version of JSR, it wouldn't, you know, be rocket science to do so. So the web app and the infrastructure right now are pretty basic, and we hope it kind of stays that way.
I remember talking to like a Laurie boss about NPM and all the just crazy horror stories of, oh my gosh, you know, like when they first started, like the registry was like always down, or, you know, the rest. Adam, were you there? I think we were talking at Render. I don't know if you were like in the room or not, but it was pretty hilarious.
I was there and I talked a lot to Laurie, and that's how I knew that Netlify functions run Dino under the covers. But no, I wasn't there for that. He's talked many times about the reliability problems NPM had in the early days before they got serious funding and they were a little bit more sketchy and, well, unreliable.
Yeah, I mean, NPM is just like an incredible project in general, like the like where it started, where it is right now. Like Node maybe gets a lot of the credit for being the transformative technology, but like NPM is really like why JavaScript is the lingua franca of software development, is just because the ecosystem is so powerful. So it's a pretty sweet project.
It's funny you say that, because one of the Ryan Dahl's top 10 regrets of Node was coupling it so tightly to NPM, and yet a Dino employee, sorry, I'm not trying to get you fired, but it's funny hearing you say that that's one of the big reasons why Node took off, just because of that tight NPM coupling.
Well, I think like maybe both of those things can be true at the same time. Like probably like coupling the package manager to the runtime was probably not necessary, which is like with JSR is kind of what we're finding. Like there's really no reason to tie it specifically to Dino. Like it works just as well in the context of Cloudflare workers as it does in, you know, Dino. So I do think like tightly coupling them was a problem, or like you could argue that it is maybe like not the technically correct decision, but yeah, I mean, I would definitely stand by the fact that like Node is very important, but like Node wouldn't have succeeded without, you know, Express and all the rest of the ecosystem in NPM sprouting up around it, which I think you could probably argue NPM is the most successful package manager that exists, you know, on the internet today, kind of anywhere. So like, yeah, and I think like that's a big part of why. And it was reasonably easy to publish to it as well. Like that was... I used to maintain a package on like for Maven way back in the day, and that was not a fun prospect, but NPM was much better by comparison. So
I was going to say NPM is one of the easiest to use too. I remember suffering with NuGet back in my corporate .NET days, and that was just miserable.
Yes,
I hated
absolutely.
It. Terrible.
Yeah, I never had to maintain a NuGet package, but they're the folks at Twilio who published to that particular registry didn't seem to be like stoked at the prospect.
Also,
if someone is listening, I'm sorry, I still love your work. Please don't block me on Twitter.
Yes, certainly nothing but love for the NuGet, but.
But I mean, seriously, missed opportunity for Nugget. I mean, just talking about a lot of missed opportunities there.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know where that comes from, but yes, Nugget would have been more fun.
Wait, is it Nugget or Nuget?
I've only ever heard Nuget, but they should just say Nugget. Like that is more fun. It kind of rolls off the tongue.
Talk a little bit about like the growth strategy or the evangelism strategy here, because you know I can remember when Yarn first got introduced, and it felt like that overnight became the thing everyone needed to use. There was like a time when it just felt like people were so willing to just all pile into the new thing and immediately adopt it. And I don't know if that's lessened over time or people are just becoming a little bit more stubborn or what it is, but I think both Dino and maybe JSR will face this where even though they have amazing features, people don't necessarily fully understand why they should make the swap immediately until maybe it gets to that inflection point where it goes from just being a thing you could do to the thing that everyone's doing and it flips. I know Ryan Carniato has called this like it needs to be 10x better, he jokes, before people will start to peel off from the default solution to the new solutions. So like, what is the strategy for kind of building these up? Is like slow and steady the way? Is it just trying to surprise people? Like, how do you get people to not only be aware of it, but then to try it and be turned by it? How do you kind of see that growth strategy for this?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the way in which you have to approach it is like for something like JSR, and where you mentioned the example of Yarn, Yarn, at least initially, was almost zero cost to adopt. Like you could just, instead of start using NPM or instead of using NPM, you could use Yarn and basically do exactly the same thing. But Yarn was, you know, slightly more efficient and could do the same job quite a bit faster, like especially in the early days for basic use cases. Of course, like the devil is in the details, right? And like there was maybe a lot of things that Yarn had to figure out and is still figuring out to this day. But the I think like that can be part of it. If you can do, I don't know if 10x is the right multiplier, but if you can do the same thing pretty significantly better at almost zero cost to switch, then that becomes pretty compelling, and folks will kind of take free money if they can get it. I think like one thing, the Bun runtime, for example, like is you're starting to see it kind of pop up in different projects, but like as a package manager, because the way that their like download implementation happens is quite a bit faster. Well, I'm not familiar enough with the implementation to like be able to tell you exactly why, but it's just significantly faster at downloading and managing getting packages into your Node modules folder, and it is largely zero cost to adopt, as long as you're not like depending on any kind of specific strange behavior of like existing NPM clients, which sometimes you are. So I think like from an adoption standpoint, the experience has to be about that frictionless, where you can just say like, all right, this is pretty significantly better for these reasons. And I think like in the case of JSR, and we'll get to Dino in a sec, the like as a module author, it's very nice to just manage a TypeScript code base and just work with your TypeScript source, like versus having to think through like how am I going to create like my common JS interface and also my ESM interface and create these types. There's a lot of like schlepping that happens around that. It's nice to have the API documentation automatically generated and having the front end set up in such a way where like you can set up GitHub in a couple of minutes. Like, those things are enough better where, like, if on the consumer side, if there isn't very much friction to adopt, then, you know, you that the pieces might be there for migration relatively quickly. So I think, you know, doing a little bit of education for module authors specifically is something that I'm thinking about a lot. And like, how can I help as many module authors as possible, like realize like, oh, I could actually save a lot of time, make my life a little bit easier if I publish my module in this way. So that's kind of the angle at which I'm looking at it is like, I think the for consumers, the cost of switching is probably is already pretty low, and we could probably even drive it lower than it is. But if module authors can see like a significant savings of their time and like a UX improvement by, you know, using JSR, then I think eventually we'll be able to get folks to look at it. With Dino, I think there is something that we're actually realizing like from the first versions of the project is like there were good reasons to kind of deviate from what Node was doing at the time. Like there is a desire to hew closer to web standards where, you know, import, like one of the major sort of like features that look exotic in Dino when you first see it is the this concept of like an HTTP import. So instead of like import foo from bar where bar maps to some like NPM package or some built-in Node module, you can specify like a fully qualified URL to like a TypeScript file that exists somewhere on the internet, much like you would in a script tag, which is what where kind of that idea comes from and how in the browser, like if you were using the import syntax, that's it would look very much like that. And you always include like the file extension in it because in a browser, you always include the file extension when you're loading a script from a server. So there were some things that were done kind of because in many like arguable senses, they were like correct, like supporting ESM modules only. Like ESM is now the, you know, accepted web standard way in which you package up and share JavaScript code, which didn't exist when Node was originally created, which is why we have, you know, CommonJS. But like, there's just such a gravitational pull of like, especially like the NPM ecosystem and just so much code that's been written for Node, like Node compatibility and like being really good at absorbing as much of that into Dino as possible. Started off as less of a concern for the project, but now is like our primary concern. It's like, how can we make Dino as compatible with as much of the Node ecosystem as possible with as little configuration as possible? So I think with JSR, we're kind of starting from that viewpoint of like, we really have to integrate with what the rest of the ecosystem is doing and work really well across different environments. In Dino, we're moving more in that direction where like the happy path of Dino is still very happy. Like you can, if you're starting from a green field, but if you're not starting from a green field, that experience has to be much, 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 much better. Like we have to work with all the meta frameworks that sit on top of Node, like all the, your Next.js's and your Astros and what have you. Those have to work really well. So for Dino 2.0, which we're hoping to release later on this year, we'll see. I'm hopeful that it's the summer, but like we have some targets for like framework compatibility, for Node compatibility that we're trying to hit before we sort of declare 2.0, at which point we'll switch some of the default ways in which Dino operates to be much, much more compatible with like existing Node projects, say. So yeah, looping all the way back to evangelism, I think that's the way you do it. Like you have to be able to work really well and play nicely with what folks in the ecosystem are already using. And I think that's kind of where we need to push harder with Dino.
You may have said it and I missed it. Is there any compatibility the other direction? Like if I'm a package author, the value of JSR might be pretty obvious and I might be eager to publish it there. But if I do, NPM consumers can't pull down from JSR and have it work, can they?
The way that it works is because JSR is a custom like registry. It's kind of like you if your company had like a private NPM registry that you had to configure, that's kind of how JSR works with an existing Node project. So there's actually like an NPX command, or like you could also install it globally, but you do NPX, you know, JSR add, you know, package name. And what that will do is it creates a NPM RC configuration file if one doesn't exist already, like in the current Node like project. And that is where you specify a custom registry. Like you can specify a scope which maps to another registry, like an NPM registry URL. And normally that's, again, used for like internal NPM registries. We're actually using it just to provide an alternative registry. And then that add command also adds an entry to your package.json, which has like the necessary configuration to say this dependency at Kevin Winery slash or at kwinery slash fetchling or whatever your dependency is actually maps to this JSR package. But from that point going forward, you can just like npm install, npm update, like, and it just sort of works like any, you know, npm based project after that. But there is a little bit of, it's just like a different installation command, which kind of sets all that up for you.
So, you know, open source is great, and this is all great, and, you know, investors, I guess invest, when you look at it from an investor standpoint, right, investors, I think sometimes invest, they say, whoa, all this traction, you're going to get tons of developers, so you've got to be able to monetize them somehow, right? And I know you all have, like, an offering, but what's the, you know, is it just building a better, like, registry, and that's like the thing, or like, what are you all optimizing for? Is it the enterprise offering, or?
Yeah. That's investors do like to understand how you plan to make money, like at some point in the future. That is definitely fair observation. But with JSR specifically, like that we very much don't see like a commercial angle on. Like that's why we made it open source and self-hostable, and it's something that we want to operate just as like a public utility and something that's going to be useful to you. You know,
for what reason though? Like how does it feed into?
The hope is that like, well, I mean, ultimately we do want to see more people using Dino, and I think that like that will be something that if you use JSR, you will see like, oh, okay, like it actually works really well with Dino. So we think like there will be some amount of like evangelism impact from like if JSR is successful, even in the context of Node projects, that is still beneficial to like introduce more developers to the experience of using Dino. And more people are using the Dino open source runtime, that creates more opportunities for us to provide like the types of cloud offerings that we're looking at, where, you know, if we can provide the best way to run Dino code, in, you know, whether it's like in our edge hosting environment. We also have this offering called subhosting, which is the thing that Netlify uses actually, but it's essentially a way to like send untrusted JavaScript code to our cloud and like have it execute on a URL without having to worry about like the sandboxing and the other stuff that you would have to build if you like built that yourself. So like, again, I used to work at Twilio. Twilio has this feature called like Twilio functions, where like in the console for Twilio, you can plop in like a little chunk of JavaScript code that'll execute every time you receive an incoming like text message or phone call or whatever. And a lot of products like have that or need that or want that. They want to be able to extend their platform with custom code at various places. And Dino's offering is very good at doing that. So having the Dino runtime be something that is sort of commonly adopted within the server-side JavaScript development space like makes those types of offerings slightly more compelling. So there's not like a direct commercial objective of like, oh, we need to sell Dino. But like if Dino is successful as an open source project, that creates opportunities like elsewhere for us to benefit from the fact that lots of developers use Dino.
Well, we ran out of time because we're at time, but it was so much fun chatting with you and learning a little bit more about all this. And Adam, have you tweeted yet?
Tweet
Not
check.
Yet. I think Brian's going to send you some hate mail because his quote about 10x better was taken a little bit out of context. And this is like a sore point for him. So that's going to be.
Oh, is it? No, I didn't realize.
I heard him joking about it on one of his Friday streams.
Yeah, someone else said it about React. They were like, I'm not even going to look at anything that's not React unless it's 10x better.
10x better, and, you know, yeah.
Ryan's trying this to compete is... with React, so.
Yeah. but anyways, you can find more about Modern Web. You know, we actually have, I think we have a website, you know, and you can like download this place. So if you're listening on the podcast, you can actually look at our faces on YouTube. And, you know, that may make you like us better or may not, either way, you know.
I could see that breaking in either direction.
I know, right?
Yeah, sorry, Tracy. I think oh, you got sent for that.
Wait, seriously? Dang it.
I may have dropped an F-bomb just now. I'm sorry.
At 34:55, I'll make a mark. But anyways, you can find us on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Lady Leet or on LinkedIn at Tracy S. Lee. Adam is at Adam Rackus. Got to make fun of your LinkedIn. I don't know if we're friends yet. And then Rob is at RoboCell on Twitter. And then Kevin, where are you on Twitter?
I'm at Kevin Winery on Twitter. And then annoyingly at K Winery on GitHub and other platforms. So I didn't enforce the, you know, uniformity I should have, but definitely can find me there.
Yeah. I should have taken the Tracy Lee, but then this, like, I don't know what she is. She's like one of those WWE women or something, some sort of model in Sacramento that does like MMA maybe, you know, she took all the Tracy Lee. So I need to just
be Lady Lee. Like all your like search rankings. So if somebody, yeah. Oh, that's a bummer.
So I am not the MMA model though. Lives in Sacramento,
yet.
California.
Yeah.
I could be. I should fight her for it, you know?
Yeah. Fight. In the end, there can be only one.
Yeah. But thanks everyone for listening, and definitely check out all the stuff Kevin talked about, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is sponsored by This.Labs, a framework agnostic consultancy that specializes in JavaScript. You can find them at this.co/labs. That's THISDOT.CO/labs. For all of your friends and you, do-ba-do-do-do, yeah, query, shout it, yeah, queries do, so come on, let's go, 'cause we got a show for you.